awed by the thought that the girls would travel together, although not enough to prevent a deluge of unwanted advice for the weeks leading up to their departure. Alice was convinced that naval transport ships were hotbeds of immorality. Bailyn's cousin had worked as a cook on a troop ship during the war, and she had described with some relish an endless trail of bored naval wives traipsing backwards and forwards down the narrow staircases that led to the men's quarters. Joy wasn't sure which her mother was more shocked by, the idea of extramarital activity, or that it was with men lower than officer class. Stella's mother, whose ever-present nerves seemed to jangle like wind chimes at the best of times, was more concerned about the recent sinking of the Empire Windrush, which had gone down in a storm off Malta. But Stella and Joy, free for the first time from the watchful eyes of their parents, had determined to make the most of their adventure. Except that, several weeks in, Stella's idea of what that meant had turned out to be somewhat different from Joy's. "Right, I'm off for a quick stroll," Stella said, unfolding her smooth tanned limbs from the sunbed and nodding to Georgina Lipscomb. Georgina gazed up at her. It was impossible to tell what she was thinking behind her sunglasses. "Anywhere nice?" she said. Stella gestured vaguely towards the bow of the ship. "Oh, just need to stretch my legs a bit," she said casually. "See what any of the others are up to. Most chaps seem to have stayed in their cabins today." Joy stared at Stella, conscious of her friend's refusal to meet her eye. "Have fun," said Georgina. She smiled, her teeth even and white below her sunglasses. Stella stood and, wrapping her bathing gown around her, walked briskly towards the bar. Joy, feeling suddenly aggrieved, fought the temptation to follow her. There was a brief silence, during which Georgina accepted another drink from the Goanese waiter who had appeared beside her. "Your little friend wants to watch herself, darling," she said, still smiling inscrutably from behind her sunglasses. "No faster way to get a name for oneself than to play around on the water." Joy lay on her bunk, her stockinged feet stretched out in front of her, positioning herself between the window and open door to catch a breeze. In these last days of the journey, she had spent many afternoons in this manner, unwilling to spend her entire day in the company of the other wives and their fractious, bored children, or the officers who would congregate in the bars, reminiscing of battles past and exclaiming over the foibles of mutual acquaintances. When they had set out, Joy had been almost breathless with excitement, desperate to start out on the first real adventure of her life. But since they had begun the long route from Bombay towards Suez, the days seemed to have slowed and stalled as the temperatures rose, their worlds narrowing to the familiar bases of bar, deck and dining room, so that they had all begun to feel like fixtures on board, rarely even bothering to venture ashore at the various ports of call. It gradually became harder to imagine real life existing elsewhere, and consequently some chose not to try, letting themselves be carried by the gentle rhythms of life on board and swayed by the simmering heat, so that their previous pursuits, deck tennis, afternoon walks, swimming, had gradually become too much effort, and even conversation had become sparse. Increasingly now, passengers were sleeping in the afternoon or watching movies in the evening, only a few singing listlessly as they followed the bouncing ball on the screen. At night they would gaze unseeing at unearthly iridescent sunsets, inured by repetition to their extraordinary beauty. Only those, like Georgina Lipscomb, who were forced out by the insistent requirements of their children, found themselves engaged in any kind of activity. Stella became bored and restless, so that sometimes Joy preferred it when she disappeared. But it all suited Joy, who, having found the narrow parameters of ship life a little too close to those she had left in Hong Kong, found she could indulge her antisocial nature without remark. She liked to retire alone to the cabin when she knew the others would all be out, and gaze at what she privately thought of as her Edwardian treasures. His letters, which were fast becoming grubby and fragile from overhandling, her framed wedding photograph of them both, and the little Chinese painting, a blue horse on rice paper, that Edward had bought her on their first day of married life, strolling through Hong Kong. He had roused her early, and she had opened her eyes wide, briefly uncomprehending in her half-slumber how she could have ended up in the same bed as this man. When she remembered, she had reached for him, linking her arms languorously around his freckled neck, squinting against the light. He had pulled her closer, murmuring softly. She could hear nothing but the whispered rustling of the sheets. Afterwards, as the sweat cooled on her exposed skin, he had pushed himself up on one elbow and kissed her lightly on the nose. "Let's get up," he whispered. "I want us to have our first morning by ourselves before the others get up. Let's disappear." Joy had fought a vague feeling of disappointment that he didn't want to stay in their honeymoon bed and wrap his warm limbs around hers. But anxious to please, she had raised herself and climbed into the raw silk dress and short jacket that her mother had had made for her going away outfit. They had ordered tea from room service and drunk it swiftly, gazing shyly at each other across the breakfast table, and then had emerged blinking onto the rude, honking streets of the capital, their senses assaulted by the battery of sights, sounds, and less than fragrant smells that constituted Kowloon in the early morning. Joy had stared at it all with the stunned incomprehension of a newborn, wondering at how different the world could look in 24 hours. "We'll get the Star Ferry," Edward said, clutching her hand and pulling her towards the terminal. "I want to take you to Cat Street." Joy had never been to Cat Street Market. Her mother, had she dared to suggest it, would have paled, pointing out its history as a haven for criminals and prostitutes, except her mother would have called them loose women, and remarking that no one of any class ever went there. It was also at the western end of the island, in an area Alice would have described, somewhat perversely, as too Chinese. But as they sat on the wooden seats of the ferry, cocooned in newly married bliss and oblivious to the chattering voices around them, Edward told her that since the 1949 revolution in China, the area had been flooded with family possessions, many of which were valuable antiques. "I want to buy you something," he said, tracing her palm with his finger, "so you've got something to remember me by until we see each other again. Something special to you and me." He had called her Mrs. Ballantyne then, and Joy had flushed with pleasure. Every time he reminded her of her wifely status, she couldn't help but think of the marital intimacies of the night before. By the time they arrived, it was shortly after 7, but Cat Street Market was already teeming with life. Traders cross-legged behind flat cloths, upon which sat old watches, or intricately carved jade on red thread. Old men seated on benches next to small fluttering birds in their cages. Ornate gilded trunks, enameled furniture, all overlaid by the sweet fried smell of turnip paste, cooked by hawkers who catcalled and shrieked, speaking so fast that even Joy, who knew far too much Cantonese for her parents' comfort, could not hope to understand. It had felt like the Wild West. But Joy, observing Edward's enthusiasm, had fought the urge to cling to him. He didn't want a clinging wife. He had told her as much the evening before. He liked her strength, her independence, that she didn't flap and flutter like the other officers' wives he knew. He had known only one other woman like her, he said quietly, as they had lain entwined in the dark. He had loved her, too. But she had died during the war, killed by a bomb in Plymouth, where she had been visiting her sister. Joy had felt her heart clench when he mentioned the word love, despite knowing that this woman could no longer be a threat in the conventional sense. And with that emotion had come the terrifying realization that from now on her happiness was a captive thing, hostage to his unthinking words, almost entirely dependent on the kindness of another. Look, he said, pointing at an overcrowded stall. That's it. What do you think? Joy had turned to follow his finger and seen a small picture framed in bamboo, propped up against an ornate iron pot. In loose brushstrokes of ink on white paper, it showed a blue horse, twisted as if in the act of breaking free, yet surrounded by dark lines that suggested some kind of border. Do you like it? He said. His eyes were shining, childlike. Joy stared at the picture. She didn't, really. Or at least, she wouldn't have noticed it if it had been just her looking. But his expression prompted her to try to see it through his eyes. I love it, she said. Her husband wanted to buy it. For her, his wife. I really love it. How much? He motioned at the stallholder, who had been eyeing them, taking in the good clothes, the naval whites. From behind his long, stringy moustache, he shrugged as if he couldn't understand. Joy paused and glanced at Edward. Guido sin ar? She asked. The stallholder looked at her, then shrugged again. Joy stared at him, knowing he understood her. "'Am goi lai sin san,' she said more sweetly. "'Guido sin a?' The man removed the clay pipe from his lips, as if considering something. Then he named a figure, an exorbitant figure. Joy looked at him incredulously. "'Peng di la!' she exclaimed, asking him to think again. But the man shook his head. She turned to Edward, trying to keep the fury from her voice. He's being ridiculous, she said quietly. He's asking for 10 times what it's worth, just because you're wearing your uniform. Let's move on. Edward gazed at Joy and then at the stallholder. No, he said. Just tell me how much. I don't care what it costs today. You're my wife. I want to buy you a present. This present. Joy squeezed his hand. That's lovely, she said. But I can't take it. Not at that price. Why? Joy gazed at him, wondering how to say what she meant. It would ruin it for me, she said silently. Because when I looked at it, I wouldn't see your love for me. I would see you being conned by an unscrupulous man. And that's not how I want to think of you. Look, she murmured into his ear. The smell of him distracted her, making her wish suddenly that they were not in this market at all, but back in their hotel room. Let's just pretend to walk on. It'll frighten him into thinking he's losing the sale. Then he'll probably offer something reasonable. But the man just stood and watched as they walked away, so that Edward became increasingly agitated. There was nothing else he liked, he said, as they browsed stall after stall. The picture was perfect. He wanted to buy the picture. Let's go into the temple, said Joy, gesturing at the vibrant red and gold of the Man Mo temple on the corner of Hollywood Road, where incense smoke seethed out, as if only reluctantly offering itself to the gods on its appellant's behalf. But he said distractedly that she should go in alone. He was going to go for a little walk. He shifted a little on his feet, suggesting bladder discomfort. Joy turned away from him, feeling wretched, as if she had in some way disappointed him. The morning wasn't turning out how she'd intended. In the dark confines of the temple, she half wished she'd changed her mind. The group of Chinese people lighting their offerings in the back turned silently to look at her, the Guailo invading their sacred space. Not wishing to offend, Joy muttered a greeting in Cantonese, and this seemed to appease them a little, so that they turned away at least. Joy stared up at the ceiling, from which immense incense spirals dangled, slow burning, and wondered how soon again she could walk out, how soon she could persuade Edward to climb back aboard the Star Ferry, so that she could make the most of the last few hours they had to spend together. Then Edward appeared by her side, beaming. "I got it," he said.
"Got what?" she asked.
But she knew.
"I got it, at a good price."
He held out the little painting with both hands, as if making his own offering. "The man dropped his price when you'd gone. Must have wanted not to lose face in front of a lady, eh? I know all this face stuff is very important out here." Joy gazed at the proud, smiling face of her new husband, and at the little horse on rice paper he held before him. There was a brief pause. Then,
"Aren't you clever?" she said, kissing him. "I absolutely love it."
He was so pleased as they walked out that there was really no point in her mentioning that she had never actually told him the price to begin with. Joy, wiggling her toes at the door, stared at the blue horse, then at her wedding photograph, then debated whether to treat herself with one of his letters. She was having to ration herself now, conscious that they were falling apart, but sometimes it was so hard to conjure him up without them. She could get bits of him, the tenor of his voice when he laughed, his broad hands, the way his legs looked in his whites, but it was increasingly difficult to picture him as a whole. The last few weeks before they had boarded the ship, she had felt quite panicked because she had barely been able to do it at all. 1 week and 4 days, she told herself, now so expert at such mental arithmetic that the dates came as naturally to her as her own birthday. "Then I will see him again."
"Are you nervous?"
Stella asked her the previous week, as they had discussed what they would wear for the day they met their husbands.
"I know I will be. Sometimes I wonder if I'll actually recognize him."
It had been less than 3 months since Stella had seen Dick, an age less time than Joy. But Joy wasn't nervous. She just wanted to see him, wanted to feel the solidity of his embrace, to see his face shine like the sun down upon her. When she had told the other wives this during a hairstyling session, Stella had made a fake gagging sound, which Joy had found hurtful, even if she understood why Stella was doing it, and the other wives had exchanged knowing looks. Like her mother's all those months ago, they suggested that she was still an innocent, a naive, with a lot to learn about men and married life. Only Mrs. Fairweather had smiled and nodded as if she understood. But her husband had never been in the services, and appeared to be joined to her at her well-padded hip. Joy had not said anything public about Edward after that. She had kept him to herself, as if guarding some precious secret. "One letter," she told herself, unfolding the most recent, like someone unwrapping a particularly succulent chocolate. "One letter a day until I see him again, and then I will pack them away for safekeeping, so that I can look at them when I am an old, old woman, and remember how it was to be separated from the man I love." The atmosphere altered subtly as they approached the Suez Canal, the faint buzz of potential conflict rousing the passengers from their dreamlike state. The words Suez and government were bandied about at supper, and the men, conversing in huddles, would look terribly serious, so that Joy, who had no idea what its significance might be, found herself almost anxious and rather glad of the presence of servicemen. The Brits, according to the first officer, still occupied the African side of the canal. "But I wouldn't go too near the sides of the decks while we're inside it," he advised gravely. "You can't trust those Arabs. We've had reports of them galloping up and down the shoreline bearing arms, and it's not unknown for them to use foreign ships for a bit of target practice." All the women had gasped at this and clutched their necks theatrically, while the men nodded sagely, muttered about the Aswan Dam, and acted as though the women were flapping. Joy hadn't gasped. She was electrified. And despite the dire warnings, she was unable to stay inside while the SS Destiny passed through the canal, but often sat alone outside, her head camouflaged by her sun hat, smiling blandly at passing officers' warnings and secretly hoping to see some turbaned assassin on a camel. She knew the officers thought she was a little wild, that the Hindu deck crew were talking about her, but she didn't care. How often was she going to get the chance to take part in a real adventure? The Suez Canal itself turned out not to be the war-torn concrete-lined passage she had imagined, but a mercurial silver strip of water lined by sand dunes and punctuated by a near-silent, stately procession of ships gliding along as if strung together. It was hard to believe in this silent, orderly line that there could be anything to fear. The only real frisson she felt was that night when the captain ordered the lights to be turned out and they had all sat, temporarily hushed, in the darkened dining room. But even then she had found herself perversely grateful for the feeling that something other than bridge or deck tennis was happening. It was as the ship headed towards Egypt that the first officer told them about the fancy dress party. It would be held on the night before they docked at Southampton, a fitting climax to the voyage, and the captain had wanted to give them all enough time to prepare their costumes. Joy thought privately that he had probably wanted to distract them all from the journey through Egypt, but she said nothing as everybody got very excited, as if the mention of the final night had somehow brought it closer, and began planning their outfits.
"I want to go as Carmen Miranda, but I don't suppose they'll be able to get me the fruit," said Stella as they walked back from the dining room. Peter had not appeared at dinner that evening, which had put her in a foul temper, so Joy didn't say what she thought, that Carmen Miranda's outfit might be just a little revealing for a married woman to wear without comment. "Or I could go as Marilyn Monroe in How to Marry a Millionaire. If I could get some new trimming for my pink dress." Stella gazed at her reflection in a window. "Do you think it would be worth having my hair tinted a few shades lighter? I've been thinking about it for ages." "What would Dick say?" said Joy, aware as soon as she said it that it was the wrong thing to ask. "Oh, Dick will take me as he finds me," Stella said dismissively. "He's lucky to have me, after all."
"Peter has said that to her," thought Joy uncomfortably. It was not something the old Stella would have said. But then it was difficult to know what this new Stella was ever going to say, or indeed what it was safe to say to her. From years of feeling able to entrust her with her most painful confidences, Joy now found talking to Stella a little too close to walking on shifting sands. One had to tread carefully, and even then one never knew whether one was going to trip and fall. "Well, if you think Dick would like it, I'm sure it would look terribly pretty. But don't you want to look exactly the same as when you left him, so he doesn't feel, well, uncomfortable?"
"Oh, Dick, Dick, Dick," said Stella crossly. "Honestly, Joy, you do go on. I told you, Dick would be glad to see me if I turned up looking like an Oriental. So why don't you stop harping? It's only a fancy dress, after all."
Stung, Joy said nothing for the rest of their walk to the cabin. At which point, predictably, Stella said she couldn't face listening to those snoring kids and was going for a walk around the decks by herself. The next morning her mood had recovered, and the following few days she became a little more like the old Stella, engrossed in trying to find the right materials to create her outfit. When they got to port side, a couple of traders were allowed to come aboard with trinkets and beads in huge wooden baskets, so so that even those women like Mrs. Fairweather, who would normally have dismissed the Egyptians as beneath their consideration, found themselves fussing and fighting over trimmings and feathers in a manner that was, according to Georgina Lipscomb, frankly undignified. Joy tried to engage herself in thoughts of costumes and disguise, but as they entered the milder waters of the Mediterranean, all she could think of was that within days now, not weeks, she would see Edward again. Sometimes she fancied she could even feel his increasing proximity as a physical presence, although no doubt Stella would have made gagging noises at that, too. On the night of the party, they were to cross the last lengthy stretch of water and enter the English Channel. The Bay of Biscay, the old travelling hands warned, was renowned for its choppy waters, so the girls should keep a hold of their glasses. "And if they can't keep a hold of their glasses, they can keep a hold of me," Peter had said too loudly, so that the women nearest him shrank away discreetly, their smiles calcifying on their faces. But the prospect of the party, or its proximity to home, had gradually infected everyone, so that on the last evening, even as the decks became cold and wet with Atlantic spray, whoops of misbehaviour could be heard as various exotically costumed passengers ran from one cabin to another. Mr. and Mrs. Fairweather had dressed as an Indian Rajah and his wife, wearing genuine costumes which they had acquired during a short and, according to Mrs. Fairweather, rather testing posting to Delhi, and which they appeared to carry with them on sea journeys in case of such events. Mrs. Fairweather had painted her face and arms with cold tea to get just the right shade for an Indian, she assured everyone authoritatively, tugging at her exotic fabrics, to disguise the flashing revelation of pale flesh around her middle. Stella, having given up on Marilyn after being told what ship's bleach would do to her hair, had metamorphosed into Rita Hayworth in Salome, sporting an outfit from which at least two of its seven veils were missing. She was peeved to find herself, if not outshone, then at least equalled by Georgina Lipscomb, who had persuaded one of the naval officers to lend her his whites, and looked astoundingly glamorous with her dark hair swept up under its peaked cap. Joy had left it all too late, and subsequently been rather uninspired, so Stella had made her a foil crown and told her to go as the queen. "We can trim my purple robe with cotton wool to look like ermine, and she doesn't wear a lot of makeup, so you'll be quite comfortable," she said. Despite her passion of less than a year ago, Stella was no longer interested in Elizabeth. After a brief spell of Princess Margaret, much better dress sense, she had moved on to Hollywood. Joy felt rather silly as Queen Elizabeth, unsure whether it was the presumptuousness of the choice or the childishness of her outfit that was making her more uncomfortable. But when they finally arrived in the dining hall and Joy caught sight of some of the other outfits, her mood lightened. Peter had dressed as an Egyptian trader, his body exposed from the waist and blacked up with what could have been boot polish, so that his muscles glowed and rippled in the dimmed lights. His blonde hair was covered with a woolly black cap, crocheted by the elderly Mrs. Tennant, and he carried a basket of beads and wooden carvings. Thoroughly overexcited already, every now and then he launched himself at one of the women, who would squeal theatrically and wave him away, laughing, yet looking faintly cross. He never launched himself at Joy. "Have I gone blotchy?" said Mrs. Fairweather, approaching her as she sat down at the table. "I'm sure the spray has given me spots." Joy studied her tea-stained complexion. "It looks fine to me," she said. "But I'll touch it up if you like. I'm sure one of the waiters will do us some cold tea." Mrs. Fairweather pulled her compact from her handbag and studied her reflection, straightening the jewels in her headdress. "Oh, I'm sure I don't want to bother them. They'll all be terribly busy tonight. It's a special supper, I'm told." "Hello, Joy. Or should I say, Your Majesty?" It was Louis who bowed low before her, then took her hand and kissed it, making Joy blush.
"I must say, you look like you were born to it, doesn't she, Mrs. Fairweather?"
He was wearing a scruffy tweed skirt and a headscarf, as well as a rather alarming shade of lipstick.
"Oh, definitely," said Mrs. Fairweather. "Positively regal she looks."
"Oh, please don't," said Joy, laughing, as Louis sat down beside her. "I shall get ideas above my station."
"May I ask what on earth you have come as?"
"Can't you tell?" Louis looked downcast.
"I can't believe you can't tell."
Joy looked at Mrs. Fairweather and back again. "I'm sorry," she said.
"I'm a land girl," he said, holding up a pitchfork.
"Look, I bet you can't believe I got hold of this."
"A land girl?"
Mrs. Fairweather laughed.
"Now I see it," she said. "Can you see it, Philip? Mr. Baxter's come as a land girl. Look, he's even got a bag of potatoes."
"What's a land girl?" said Joy tentatively.
"Where have you been, Timbuktu?"
Joy looked around her to see if anyone else shared her lack of knowledge. But Stella was squealing at Peter, and Georgina Lipscomb was talking to the first officer, and the only other bystander, a ballet dancer with suspiciously hairy legs, didn't appear to be listening.
"When did you last come to England?" said Louis.
"Oh, gosh, when I was a child, I think," said Joy.
"When Hong Kong was invaded, we were all sent to stay in Australia."
"Fancy that, Philip. Joy didn't know what a land girl was."
Mrs. Fairweather nudged her husband, who, from under his turban, was gazing benignly at his gin and tonic.
"Fancy," he said mildly.
"Did you really never see one?"
Joy felt rather awkward. There was always something in gatherings like these, she observed, to make her feel ignorant or stupid. That was why she loved Edward. He never made her feel that way.
"I don't suppose there was any reason why Joy should know what a land girl was," said Louis briskly. "I'm sure there are loads of things about Hong Kong that I should never understand. Can I get you a drink, Joy, Mrs. Fairweather?"
Joy smiled at him, grateful for his solicitousness, and the moment passed. The swell built up gradually as they finished their main course, so that the waiters had occasionally to clutch at passing bits of furniture to avoid dropping the plates, and the wine in Joy's glass tipped at alarmingly violent angles.
"It's always like this," said Louis, who was seated next to her.
His lipstick had rubbed off with his meal, so that she could look at him now without giggling.
"First time I came across, I slid right off my bunk in my sleep."
Joy didn't mind. Every huge wave brought her closer to Tilbury. But some of the ladies exclaimed disapprovingly, as if there should be someone to blame for this meteorological lack of consideration. Their voices rose shrilly, like those of the gulls above the music, which the captain had ordered to continue, even though the musicians kept having to steady themselves, and it became increasingly disjointed. It was at this point that Stella, making her way unsteadily towards the restrooms, had almost fallen over, and Peter had leapt up to help her, sending his chair crashing backwards. Joy saw Stella's expression as she thanked him, and felt suddenly deeply uneasy. Louis, watching her, refilled her wine glass and told her to drink up.
"If you drink enough, you'll think it's just you swaying instead of the ship," he said,
and his hand accidentally touched hers. Joy, still staring at Stella as she held Peter's supporting arm just a little too long, had almost not noticed that. So she had drunk. She had been relatively abstemious up until tonight, but now, like the others, had been infected by a sense of something ending, a recklessness brought on by their isolation and the thought of the more sober life, a more adult existence ahead. The toasts became louder and more ridiculous. To the late king, to the old country, to Elizabeth, at which she found herself standing and nodding regally, to the Lone Ranger and Tonto, to the pudding, an elaborate confection of cream, sponge and alcohol, and to the SS Destiny itself, as she lurched and swayed her way through the waves.
Joy found herself giggling, and not minding so much when Louis put his arm around her, and stopping noticing who had disappeared from the table and when. And when the captain had climbed onto the podium and announced that he was about to award the prize for the best outfit, Joy had heckled him as rudely and mercilessly as the rest of her table.
"Shh, shh, ladies and gentlemen," the first officer had insisted, tapping his brandy glass with the edge of his knife. "Quiet, please." "You know, Joy, I do think you're absolutely wonderful."
Joy tore herself away from the podium and stared at Louis, whose brown eyes had suddenly taken on the liquid longing of a puppy.
"I've been wanting to tell you since Bombay."
He placed his hand over hers, and Joy withdrew it quickly, fearful that someone might see.
"Now, ladies and gentlemen, steady, please. Come on, come on."
The captain held his hands palm down before him, then threw one up sharply as the ship lurched to starboard, so that the passengers whooped and catcalled.
"It's an awful long time to be separated from the one you love, Joy. I know that. I've got a girl at home, too. But it doesn't stop you wanting someone else, does it?"
Joy gazed at him, saddened that he had had to complicate everything. She liked him. In other circumstances, well, perhaps, but not this. Joy shook her head, trying to instill a little sense of regret into that small motion, just to save his feelings. "Let's not talk like this, Louis." Louis gazed at her for slightly too long, then looked down at the table.
"Sorry," he said. "Probably had a bit too much to drink."
"Shh," said Mrs. Fairweather. "Will you two be quiet? He's trying to speak."
"Now, I know this is the moment you've all been waiting for, and I'd like to say you've all made a tremendous effort, but that wouldn't be true."
The captain hesitated to the sound of laughter.
"No, no, I'm just joking. Now, I've deliberated long and hard over these costumes, and over some I've deliberated as long as possible."
Here he looked meaningfully at Stella's diaphanous veils. Joy, preoccupied as she was, felt relieved that Stella was still at the table. Peter had been absent for some time.
"But the overwhelming decision of myself and my colleagues has been to award our prize,"
he held up a bottle of champagne,
"to a man who has proven he is capable of barefaced cheek, literally."
The assembled passengers were quiet, waiting.
"Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Brandt, or should I say, our Egyptian trader."
The dining room burst into applause, with napkins and half-eaten bread rolls thrown high into the air. Joy, along with the rest of her table, glanced around, trying to locate Peter among the many elaborately disguised heads. As his woolly black wig failed to reveal itself, the clapping slowly filtered out, and a small murmur swelled as passengers' heads swiveled around. Joy looked up at the captain, who had been briefly silenced by Peter's non-appearance, and then at Stella, who looked equally nonplussed.
"Perhaps he's off trading," the captain joked. "I'd better get the cook to go and check on our stores."
He gazed around him, evidently wondering what to do next. He was interrupted by a whisper at the other end of the dining room. It spread down the line of tables like a soft wind, so that Joy, following its direction, eventually caught sight of its object. All eyes landed on Georgina Lipscomb, who walked unsteadily through the doors at the end, her hair now loosened from the peaked cap and hanging in loose curls around her shoulders. She staggered, trying to catch her balance, and reached out to hold the back of an unoccupied chair. Joy stared at her, trying to take in the significance of what she was seeing, then looked at Stella, who had gone quite grey. For Georgina Lipscomb's immaculate naval whites were now less than pristine. From her epaulettes down to somewhere around the middle of her thighs, her uniform bore a smudged
but definite imprint of boot polish. Georgina, apparently oblivious, stared at the faces turned towards her, and then, her head lifted, evidently decided to ignore them. Reaching their table, she sat down somewhat heavily in her chair and lit a cigarette. There was a brief, loaded silence. And then...
"You absolute tart!"
yelled Stella, and flew at her across the table, grabbing her hair, her epaulets, any flesh or uniform she could reach, before Louis and the first officer could leap from their seats to try to pull her off. Joy, stunned and frozen, simply stood, not recognizing this wild-eyed banshee as her friend, her veils tearing and ripping from her costume as she scrambled for a better hold.
"You bloody, bloody tart!"
Stella shouted, crying now, her elaborate dancing girl makeup already streaked around her eyes. Louis grabbed her arm, forcing her to relinquish her grip on Georgina's hair. But it was some seconds before either man felt confident enough to let her go. "Shh, now, dear," said Mrs. Fairweather, stroking her hair as the men sat her down. "Come on, calm down. There's quite enough excitement for one night." The entire dining room was silent. The captain motioned to the band to start playing again, but there was a long, pregnant pause before they tentatively rediscovered their place in the music. Around them, the other diners laughed in shocked tones or exclaimed in disapproval as they returned their attention slowly to their own tables. Georgina, her hair matted and bunched on one side where Stella had grabbed it, placed a hand to her face, checking for blood. Seeing no evidence of it on her fingers, she looked around the tablecloth for the lit cigarette that had been knocked out of her hand. It was floating rather forlornly in Mrs. Fairweather's drink. She removed another calmly from her silver cigarette case and lit it. Then she lifted her head and gazed at Stella. There was a brief silence. "You silly girl," she said, exhaling a long plume of smoke. "You didn't think you were the only one, did you?" Joy sat outside on the starboard deck, her arms around the sobbing Stella, wondering how long it would be before she could gently point out that not only were they both soaked, but that her teeth were chattering. Stella had cried for more than 20 minutes now, unaware of the freezing sea spray and the lurching deck, as she huddled into Joy's damp and mournful embrace.
"I can't believe he lied to me,"
she gasped during a brief interlude from sobbing.
"All those things he said."
Joy chose not to dwell on what they might have been, or what they might have led to.
"She's so awful as well. She's old, for goodness sake."
Stella gazed at Joy through eyes swollen with tears. Her voice was incredulous.
"She's got a hard face, and she wears too much makeup. She's even got stretch marks."
It was not so much that Peter had cheated on her, Joy suspected. It was what Stella saw as his indiscriminate choice of partner.
"Oh, Joy, what am I going to do?"
Joy thought back to Peter Brandt's return to the dining table. At first he had laughed and made a couple of off-colour jokes, his inebriation preventing him from picking up that the table had greeted him in stony silence. Then his laughter had become rather forced, and he had told another funny anecdote, as if trying to restore the mood. But when the captain came and plonked the bottle of champagne in front of him, curtly announcing, "You're the winner," then walked off again, Peter had twigged that all was not as it had been when he disappeared some half an hour previously. "You might need to touch up your boot polish, old boy," Louis had said, staring pointedly at Peter's pale chest, then equally pointedly at Georgina's stained frontage. For obvious reasons, it had been impossible to tell whether Peter had gone white, but he had glanced anxiously around his fellow travellers, then excused himself,
saying that he needed to stretch his legs. Georgina had looked bored, sucking at her ever-present cigarette, and managing to stare into the distance while not meeting anyone's eye. Eventually, apparently peeved by the lack of male attention, she had left the table after him. But Stella had already gone, escorted to the restroom by Mrs. Fairweather, who had wiped vainly at her face with an ill-suited lace handkerchief and appealed to her to stop crying.
"You looked so pretty with your make-up," she wittered. "You don't want to let that woman see she's got you all upset."
She had looked rather relieved when Joy came in and had handed Stella over to her, with a touch too much enthusiasm and gratitude.
"You two are friends," she said. "You know how to cheer her up. You'll tell her."
And then in a cloud of arpège, beads and translucent fabric, she had disappeared.
"What am I going to do?" said Stella a half hour later, staring out at the black and frothing sea. "Everything's finished. Maybe I should just..."
Joy followed Stella's gaze across the deck and tightened her grip on her friend's arm.
"Don't you dare talk like that," she said, panicked. "You dare even think like that, Stella Hannaford!"
Stella turned to face her, her expression free of artifice and guile.
"But what am I going to do, Joy? I've ruined everything, haven't I?"
Joy took Stella's cold hands in her own.
"You've ruined nothing! You just got a little too close to a stupid, stupid man, who, after tomorrow, you will never, ever have to see again."
"But that's the awful thing, Joy. Part of me wants to see him again."
Stella looked at her, her big blue eyes wide with misery. She let go of one of Joy's hands and pushed her hair back from her face.
"He was absolutely wonderful. Much better than Dick. And that's the worst thing. How can I go back to Dick and pretend that everything's okay when I've felt something so much more?"
Joy felt sick. Part of her wanted to block her ears, to say to Stella, "Stop, I don't want to know." But she was conscious that she was Stella's only possible confidant, the only confidant of someone who, while always a little on the dramatic side, had gazed out at those waves in a frankly unnerving manner.
"You've got to forget him," she said uselessly. "You've got to make it work with Dick." "But what if I shouldn't have married Dick in the first place? Oh, I was in love with him, I'll grant you. But what on earth did I know? I'd only kissed two men before I met him. How did I know I'd end up liking someone else better?" "But Dick's a good man," said Joy, thinking of the handsome, affable pilot. "You were so happy together. You can be again. But I don't feel like it. I don't want to have to smile at him and kiss him and let him press his horrid old body against me. I wanted Peter. And now I'm going to be stuck with someone I don't love any more for the rest of my life."
Joy placed her arms around her friend again and gazed at the dark sky. There were hardly any stars tonight, the constellations obscured by the low, mucky clouds.
"It will be all right," she murmured into Stella's cold ear. "I promise. It will all look better in the morning."
"How do you know?"
said Stella, lifting her head again.
"Because things always are. I always feel better in the daylight."
"No, not that. How do you know that you've made the right choice?"
Joy thought for a minute, not wanting to give the wrong answer. She thought briefly of Louis.
"I suppose you don't," she said eventually. "You just have to hope." "But you do. You know."
Joy was briefly silent.
"Yes,"
she said.
"How?"
"Because I don't feel properly comfortable around anyone else. Being with him, it's like being with you, except with the love thing added." She glanced at Stella, who was gazing at her attentively.
"I suppose
I feel like he's the male version of me, the better half. When I'm around him, I just want to live up to his version of me. I don't want to disappoint him.
Joy could picture him now, smiling at her, his eyes wrinkled at the corners, his teeth just visible below his upper lip.
I never really cared what anyone thought of me until he came along, she said. And now I can't believe it's me he's chosen. Every morning I wake up and thank God that he did. Every night I go to bed, praying that time will go that much faster so that I can be with him again. I think all the time about what he's doing, who he's talking to. Not in a jealous way or anything. I just want to be closer to him. And if I can imagine what he's doing, that helps.
He would be asleep now, she thought, or reading a book, probably one of his bloodstock books, full of lines of horses stretching back generations, building his dreams on an equine family tree.
He's more than I ever asked for, more than I ever hoped for, she said dreamily. I just can't imagine ever being with anyone else.
There was a brief pause. Joy realized she'd almost forgotten Stella was there. But Stella was raising herself from their seat near the lifeboats. She had stopped crying and was pulling her shawl tightly around her against the cold. Joy pushed herself upright and wiped the wet hair from her face.
Yes, well, you're lucky, Stella said, not looking Joy in the eye. It's been easy for you.
Joy frowned slightly at her friend's tone. Stella walked towards the door, then turned, so that her parting shot blew back at Joy, caught on the night spray.
Yes, much easier for you. No one else ever wanted to be with you, after all.
Chapter 7 Sabine sat on the floor in the centre of the threadbare Persian rug, staring at the picture of Stella in her midnight blue dress. The muted shades of the tired room she occupied had temporarily receded, replaced by heaving rain-lashed decks and the shimmering satin and sparkle of 7 or so waterlogged sequin veils.
Did she go back to Dick in the end?
She gazed at the twinkling eyes, the knowing smile, trying unsuccessfully to imagine this girl, desolate and abandoned on a wet ship. She looked too sure of herself. Joy, who had been sorting through a box of old certificates, peered over Sabine's shoulder.
Stella? Yes, but not for long.
Sabine turned to face her, waiting for an explanation. Joy put her box on her knees and thought for a minute.
He did adore her. But I think her feelings for Peter Brandt rather shook her up. And after a while, when no children came along, I think she decided she would rather have a bit of excitement elsewhere.
So what happened next?
Joy rubbed at her hands to try and dislodge some of the dust. She was glad that she and Sabine were talking again, but it was a little wearing the way the girl tended to pursue everything. She took a deep breath as if bracing herself, as Stella had all those years ago, to deliver bad news. She went through rather a lot of men in the end. Never quite settled with anyone.
A bit racy, said Sabine gleefully.
She rather liked the sound of Stella.
I suppose you could say that. She certainly had a good time when she was younger. It was when she got older that she became a bit sad. Used to drink rather too much.
Joy lifted a hand to her eye, which had become gritty.
Her last husband died of liver failure, and after she lost him, I think it hit home that she didn't really have anyone. She was 62 by then, you see. Rather a hard age to be totally by oneself.
Sabine tried to imagine the glowing, glamorous figure before her, not just abandoned, but as a lonely old drinker.
Did she die?
Yes, only a few years ago.
92, I think it was.
We had kept in touch, but she moved to a little apartment on the Spanish coast, and we never saw each other after that. I only discovered she'd died because her niece sent me rather a sweet letter.
Joy looked temporarily distracted.
Right, I think I should probably get rid of all these old rosettes. They look a bit mouldy. What a pity.
Sabine put the photographs back into the box in front of her, trying to imagine her mother in the place of Stella Hannaford. She was less glamorous than Stella, but on present form she could easily plough her way through loads of men and end up alone in some Spanish apartment. Sabine had a sudden vision of herself visiting her, while Kate reclined on a scruffy sofa, clutching a bottle of Rioja, reminiscing drunkenly about those she had left behind.
"Ah, Jeff,"
she would say, her red hair hanging tattily around her shoulders, her lipstick smeared gaily across her mouth.
"That was a good year. Jeff. Or was it George? I always get them mixed up."
She brushed aside the image, not sure whether it made her want to laugh or cry, then glanced surreptitiously at her grandmother. As she poured the box of old rosettes into a black plastic bag, trying instead to reconcile the stiff figure in green corduroy beside her with the perfect picture of young love that had recently taken root in her imagination. Over the past few days, Sabine found herself forced to view her grandparents in a new light. This crotchety, stilted old pair had once been a love story to rival anything on the telly. Her grandfather had been handsome. Her grandmother, well, she was handsome too. But what had really struck Sabine was that long wait, all that time apart, and she had still known all those other officers, and she had kept her faith. "No one will get engaged after one day these days," she said, thinking aloud. "Not if they had to wait a whole year afterwards, anyway." Joy, winding a piece of baling twine around the top of the bag, stopped and looked at her granddaughter. "No, I don't suppose many would."
"Would you do it again? I mean, if you had to do it now?"
Joy put the bag on the floor and stood in the centre of the room, thinking.
"To your grandfather?"
"I don't know. All right, yes, to grandfather."
Joy gazed out of the window where the rain beat down in metallic shards. Above it, a semicircular brown stain marked the place where the guttering had slipped from its place, allowing the water and other means to seep enthusiastically into the house.
"Yes," she said. "Of course." But she didn't sound convinced.
"Did you ever get nervous? I mean, even before you saw him, after all that time on the ship?"
"I told you, dear, I just felt glad to see him."
Sabine wasn't satisfied.
"But you must have felt something in those last few moments before you saw him, when you were waiting for the boat to dock and staring over the edge trying to locate him. You must have felt a bit sick. I know I would."
"It was a long time ago, Sabine. There were so many meetings, I really can't remember. Now I must get this rubbish downstairs so that we don't miss the dustbin men when they come."
Suddenly brusque, Joy brushed the dust from her front and moved towards the door.
"Come on, put those away, and we'd better go down and start on lunch. Your grandfather will be hungry."
Sabine, unfolding her limbs and standing, noted her grandmother's abruptness, but didn't really mind. Over the last couple of weeks, during which they had spent a couple of hours together most days, going through the old photographs and mementos, Joy's starchy demeanour had softened, especially when she engaged upon a long story of her and Edward's early days together. The memories would gradually loosen her sentences, stretching them into longer, free-flowing stories, infusing them with colour so that Sabine had been fascinated, happy to listen as she was allowed a glimpse into a new world of privilege and conformity and bad behaviour. And sex. It was weird to have her grandmother refer to sex. Well, she never actually said sex as such, but she had left Sabine in little doubt as to what had got Stella Hannaford and Georgina Lipscomb into such trouble. Sabine couldn't believe how much they had all been doing it in the 1950s. It was hard enough imagining that her mother did it now. Sabine thought of her mother and wondered, not for the first time, why she couldn't have had a big romantic love like her grandparents.
A real love, she thought wistfully, that survived the slings and arrows of fate, that soared like some kind of 1950s Romeo and Juliet above the petty and the mundane. The kind of love you read about in books, that inspired songs, that lifted you like a bird yet stood solid like a monolith, vast, all-encompassing, enduring.
Standing at the door, Joy turned to face her.
Come on, Sabine, do get a move on. Mrs. H is doing haddock, and if we're late taking it upstairs, it will be impossible for me to persuade your grandfather to eat it.
So what with her grandmother's thaw, and getting used to the damp, and quite enjoying all the riding, although she still couldn't bring herself to admit it, Sabine's longing for home had, if not disappeared, certainly subsided quite considerably. She didn't miss television as much anyway, and she hardly ever thought of Dean Baxter. And Mrs. H and her husband had been married for 32 years on